This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The UK's digital tech scene is accelerating, and the proof is in the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. This year, we celebrate the next generation of pioneering startups that are shaping the tech landscape of tomorrow. The UK is a thriving ecosystem with access to global talent, cutting-edge research, and unparalleled investment opportunities. Your big idea belongs here. Visit great.gov.uk/UKPA to learn more.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up, a BBC investigation reveals workers at Shein's fast fashion factories in China are enduring 75-hour working weeks. Could this impact the company's plan to list on the London Stock Exchange? Also today...
It's a lot of planning to try and, like, keep up with your own wage, because like that you don't really know, especially being a student and being casual, you don't know what you're going to get every week.
Balancing household budgets has become a more pressing concern than environmental issues for young Australians. And the financial benefits of the world's largest religious festival.
It is quite a spectacle. Millions of people gather, and the official estimates is about 400 million this time around are anticipated. So you can just imagine the kind of crowd that this entire area sees.
Listen out for that story in about 25 minutes. Let's begin with some significant news from China. On Monday, Beijing released a set of important economic data that sheds light on the state of the world's second largest economy. In 2024, China's exports surged by over 7%. Remarkably, December alone stood at an even higher year-on-year growth rate of 10.7%, surpassing all expectations. It means that China has reported the largest ever trade surplus. Here's China's trade minister, Wang Lingyong.
The total import and export value last year reached about $6.1 trillion, up by 5% year on year, setting another record high. China, as the largest trader in goods, has further consolidated its position.
So what does it tell us about the resilience of the Chinese economy and the tenacity of Chinese manufacturers in securing overseas buyers? Rory Green joins us now. He's chief China economist at Global Data, TS Lombard. So, Rory, thanks for coming on the programme. Just tell us then, what factors contributed to the increase in China's exports over the past year? And what was the thing that drove them high, so high in December?
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, so for 2024, the two main kind of structural drivers of China's surging exports, one positive, one negative. The negative was very weak domestic demand in China. People, businesses not buying many things, which meant there was a lot of stuff left to be exported globally.
Right. Does that mean that they sold it off a bit cheaper then because they had more of it?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, very weak domestic demand. You can't flog it in the Chinese market. You can lower prices and try and sell it overseas and thereby gain quite a substantial amount of trade market share. Now China has 17-18% of global trade share. That is the highest ever on record. And part of that comes from selling at lower prices.
So China is saying today, Beijing is saying that these exports surged by 7%. But do we know what the value then of that 7% is when compared with other years?
That would be in nominal terms, 7%. And if we look at it in volume terms, it's slightly higher. It's almost 10, 12, 13%, depending on how you measure it. So it's a significant difference, a greater volume in terms of, you know, the actual quantity. And then in nominal terms, because the prices have been falling, It is lower at that 7% figure.
Okay, so given that we've got Mr. Trump coming into office this time next week, a possible trade war between the two nations, how sustainable do you think this export growth is?
Not very, in simple terms. Although I should say that one of the actual other big structural driver, and this is a positive one, of China's export success is incredibly rapid movement up the value chain, being able to produce ever more advanced products at low cost. So this is thinking of EVs, solar panels, semiconductors, robotics, airplanes. And that is the actual sort of a silver lining, if you will, from Beijing's perspective, that the tech side is doing very well and enabling them to compete with countries like Germany, South Korea, Japan. So that will continue. But in the near term, a lot of this export growth, particularly in December, has been front running ahead of prospective Trump tariffs. And those tariffs, which are going to be large and they're going to come quickly, will limit the scope for Chinese export growth in 2025.
And Beijing's implementing lots of measures to try and boost the local economy. You said, didn't you, that that's the reason why this exports are so high. Is there evidence that that is actually starting to happen and that it's boosting consumer confidence?
We can see a few green shoots in two key areas, in property sales, which have been horrendous since 2021. They're finally growing again. First recorded growth in November. The high frequency data suggests the growth has continued through December and into January. And the other key area is on vehicle sales, which has been a policy target of Beijing. And those have turned up quite strongly as well. So there are green shoots, but we need to see a lot more in terms of the fiscal stimulus from Beijing around March of this year, where we'll get the full details. We need plenty more of that to continue to really set up domestic demand as a proper driver of Chinese growth.
And they're targeting every area, it seems. You mentioned kind of high-end vehicles, cars, that kind of thing. But they're also, we were reporting last week on the programme, about a scrappage scheme for things like air fryers or microwaves, dishwashers, yeah, household appliances.
Absolutely. It's a full court press, smartphones, cars, high-tech, any sort of manufacturing area. China has a lot of long-standing advantages that are only really increasing as the advanced manufacturing capability kicks in. So the stimulus will target the gamut of manufacturing items, and that's a real challenge globally going forward, not just for this year.
Rory Green, we will leave it there. Rory Green from Global Data, thank you for joining us on the programme. Well, the BBC has found that people in Chinese factories making clothes for the fashion giant Shein are working more than 75 hours a week in contravention of the country's labour laws. These working hours are not unusual in the southern city of Yangzhou, but the BBC's findings will add to a growing list of questions about working conditions in its factories. Our China correspondent, Laura Bicker, spent the day speaking to workers from dusk till dawn in the so-called Shein village to try and find out how the company makes its clothes so cheaply.
The machines seldom stop in this factory, producing clothes for the fast fashion giant Shein. The workers listen to podcasts or cooking shows as they stitch or steam fabrics. More than a dozen workers told the BBC they do this for 75 hours a week in contravention of Chinese labour laws. Most have only one day off a month. Outside, scooters rush through a warren of more than 5,000 factories, which make up the so-called Shein village in Guangzhou. At a nearby job market, workers looking for a daily paycheck examine the stitching of the kind of clothes they'd be expected to make. They get paid per piece. Their skill and speed dictate how much they make.
What do you usually make?
It depends on how difficult the item is. Something simple like a T-shirt is 1 to 2 yuan per piece, and I can make around a dozen in an hour. We earn so little. How is that enough? The cost of living is now so high.
Workers travel thousands of miles to Guangzhou to earn money to send back to their families. Shein is now one of their major employers.
I work with Shein at their first year. I watched it grow. I think Shein will get stronger and better.
There's an almost constant supply of fabric from nearby vendors. Shein's success has been possible because this city in China has everything it needs.
We've come to the textile district of Guangzhou. It's only about 10 minutes from the actual factories, and it is bustling this lunchtime. There are dozens of workers lifting heavy rolls of fabric onto trucks, onto cars, and onto, would you believe it, scooters. Now, I have no idea how they are balancing it, but on one scooter, there's at least 7 rolls of fabric.
Later, as dinner time approaches, street vendors set up stalls selling food or even offering haircuts for workers on their dinner break. Long hours are simply a way of life, and a 75-hour week is not unusual in this industrial heartland.
Well, it's not unusual, you say, but it's clear that it's illegal and it violates basic human rights.
David Hatchfield is from the Swiss advocacy group Public Eye, which has also uncovered excessive working hours in factories producing clothes for Shein.
It's an extreme form of exploitation that happens, and this needs to be visible.
In a statement, Shein told the BBC that it is committed to ensuring the fair and dignified treatment of all workers within its supply chain. And Shein says it's investing tens of millions of dollars in strengthening governance and compliance. Shein also said it was striving to set the highest standards for pay. As workers head in for the last few hours of their shift, some tell us it's their duty to work hard.
This is what we Chinese need to sacrifice for our country's development.
It's just gone 10 p.m. and finally some of the factories are beginning to empty. But I'm standing outside one factory that is still going. It seems in this part of China, the textile capital of the world, is not a place that ever fully goes to sleep.
Well, that was Laura Bicker reporting there. Shein is planning to go public with an initial public offering on the London Stock Exchange. The company has been valued at around $66 billion during its latest funding round, and the IPO could be one of the largest in London's history. Rachel Winters joins us now. She's investment manager at Killick & Co. Rachel, do you think that concerns over its supply chain practices, like those demonstrated there by Laura in her report, could affect its listing on the London Stock Exchange?
Yes, definitely. So a lot of investors, especially those in the UK, are now very focused on sustainable or ethical investing. So when you have news like this, I think it is going to deter a lot of investors from buying these shares. And we can compare it to Boohoo.com, which is also trading in London. That company was found to be using slave labour in its supply chain here in the UK, and that did have a damaging effect on the company's share price.
Rachel Winter, stay with us. We will talk to you again in a few minutes.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Moment's time. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick. Now, the cost of living pressures have overtaken climate change and the environment as the number one concern for young Australians, according to a national survey from the Christian charity Mission Australia. It's the first time that financial pressures have been the main issue in the annual Youth Survey Report, which surveyed more than 17,000 Australians aged between 15 and 19 years old. From Sydney now, let's go to our reporter, Phil Mercer.
If you don't have a roof over your head, you don't have a home type of thing. And that comes first before an issue like climate change.
Making ends meet is a constant struggle for Piper and her flatmate Callum, who are university students in Sydney. They both work long hours, but after paying for rent and food, there's not much left.
It's a lot of planning to try and, like, keep up with your own wage, because, like, you don't really know, especially being a student and being casual, you don't know what you're going to get every week.
Honestly, I think the hardest part is splitting up your paycheck and then realising that you don't have pretty much any money to put away for a rainy day fund or for travel or for something that you want to save up for, like a car. It's less of a stress and more of just a dread.
And those fears are shared by 17-year-old Ruby, who's about to leave home for the first time.
I do think that I'm going to have to work very hard to keep affording rent and everything and food and everything on top of study.
The number one concern for young Australians is the cost of living. That's overtaken climate change and the environment.
The annual survey by Mission Australia, a Christian charity, sought the opinions of more than 17,000 teenagers and young adults. Crime and mental health are key concerns, but for the first time, economic anxieties are top of the list.
Sharon Callister, Chief Executive Officer of Mission Australia. Young people are having a tough time. They are facing cost of living pressures just like the rest of the community. And if you're looking to get where's your next meal or am I going to have a safe roof over my head tonight, then clearly you can understand why climate change isn't the number one priority. Doesn't mean that it's not important for them, but they've got more urgent issues that they need to be considering.
Unlike their parents, many young Australians are entering adulthood with a sense of trepidation about money. What should be carefree days of starting work or study have become far more serious. Stuart Jackson is from the University of Sydney.
It means that people's vision for the future has been shortened to the next 2 weeks. It means that people aren't thinking about, well, where will I be in middle age? But it does mean that they've shortened their horizon. It's not, I'll finish my degree and then I'll get a good job. It's, I have to think about getting another job now to be able to pay my rent. Or I will have to go down to a food bank to try and get some food. That's a really shortened horizon. It means people don't look to the future. So politicians who talk about visions for the future are not speaking to them whatsoever.
It's important that, you know, this group enters the labour force as strong as possible. And that's, you know, for today, but also for the future.
Angela Jackson is an economist. She worries that many young people are starting their working lives feeling apprehensive.
So we know that, you know, labour force scarring is a real concern when, you know, you have a generation that's entering into the labour market during weaker economic times. That can have really long-term repercussions in terms of the earnings of that generation and of that cohort.
With an election looming, many young Australians will be voting for the first time and will have their say on efforts to ease cost of living burdens.
That was Phil Mercer reporting for us from Sydney. Well, one of the most significant factors affecting our daily budgets is the price of oil. On Monday, Brent crude oil prices reached their highest level for 4 months, tipping over $80 a barrel. This increase follows the Biden administration's introduction of a new package of sanctions against Russia, specifically targeting its oil industry. Rachel Winter is with us today. She's investment manager at Killick & Co. So which industries then will be most affected by this, Rachel?
Well, the biggest one will be the transport industry. So, for example, airlines. Oil is a huge part of their cost base, so any increase in the price of oil can really hit their profit margins.
And therefore their customers as well?
Yes, if you do have sustained increases in oil prices, then it is likely that fares would have to go up. But many airlines can take steps to try and mitigate those costs. For example, many airlines would hedge their fuel costs or look to lock in particular prices for the next 1 or 2 years so they're not overly impacted by volatility in oil prices.
I was looking at the price of the price of oil. It sort of tipped into the $80 a barrel, you know, a few months ago, as we said, like 4 months ago. But besides that, it's been around 70, 75, hasn't it?
It has. So if we go back to the end of last year, it was closer to $70. Now, as you say, it's above 80. So it certainly has come up a lot. But if we go back to 2022, just after Russia invaded Ukraine, at that point it briefly went up to $140 and it spent a lot of that year above $100. So at least it's not as high as it was back then.
Now, developing countries will feel this a lot, won't they? Higher energy costs constrain their budgets and hinder their economic development.
Yes, and if we look at China and India in particular, those are the largest two developing economies. They have been able to import a lot of oil from Russia, but these new sanctions will make it more difficult for them to do that, and they will have to compete with other countries, including Europe, to export oil from other places, for example, the Middle East. So that's likely to get more expensive.
And regions in the world, you mentioned Europe, are they going to be the worst hit, do you think, by this, by these sanctions?
That's only one of them. So Europe is a big importer of oil, so therefore it does stand to lose from these higher prices, whereas the US, by contrast, is able to produce a lot of its own oil, so it won't be hit so hard by these rising prices.
And other oil-producing nations, why might we see them increasing their output and maybe plugging the shortfall left by these sanctions?
Yes, we certainly could have a bit of that. So OPEC, for example, which controls a lot of oil production, OPEC has been holding back on supply over the last few months to try and prop the price up. Now that the price is higher anyway, perhaps OPEC will start to pump a bit more oil, which could help the price to come down a little bit.
Looking at the value of the pound, the UK pound, the Great British pound, it's now at its lowest level against the dollar since November 2023. UK borrowing costs has risen as the markets opened this morning as well. Is this a sign that investors are concerned about the UK economy and expectations of a higher interest rate?
A little bit, yes. I think there's two things happening here. So, yes, I think there is a bit of concern about the state of the UK finances and about the lack of growth here in the UK. But if we are comparing the pound to the dollar, we also have to look at what's happening in the US. And at the moment, it does appear the US economy is doing very well. And that means the interest rates in the US are likely to remain higher. And that means that more people want to hold dollars. So that's another reason why we've seen the dollar strengthening in comparison to the pound.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for explaining that, Rachel Winter, as ever. Sorry if the line was a little bit hard to hear. We've been having some technical gremlins today. Well, finally today, hundreds of millions of people are arriving in Uttar Pradesh in India for what's been described as humanity's largest religious gathering. The Kumbh Mela, which lasts for 6 weeks and is held every 12 years, is expected to generate around $3.5 billion in revenue. And businesses of all sizes, from corporate firms to small vendors, are eager to benefit from the influx of visitors attending this remarkable event. Well, the BBC's Arundhati Mukherjee has been looking at the financial benefits of the festival.
It is quite a spectacle. Millions of people gather, and the official estimates is about 400 million this time around are anticipated. So you can just imagine the kind of crowd that this entire area sees. It's sprawling over the riverbanks of the river Ganga in the city of Prayagraj, in the most populous state of Uttar Pradesh in northern India. Millions of people today have taken the holy dip, and it is referred to as humanity's biggest gathering. It's held every 12 years. Starting now, will be held over the next 6 weeks. Devotees will be bathing in the river. It's said that by doing that, they will cleanse themselves of their sins. But I think there is, of course, a religious side to it, faith and religion, but there is also a huge business and economic side of this, because it creates a massive opportunity for the state to generate a lot of money as well.
And where will most of that money be made?
Well, mostly it would be made by the hospitality sector. The organizers are expecting a huge number of people. So the hospitality industry is looking to make quite a bit of money. Especially hotels alone are expected, according to some estimates, to generate nearly $700 million. If I could just take you through some of the estimates so far and the studies that have been conducted. Of course, we'll have the exact figures when the Kumbh Mela actually ends in 6 weeks' time. But the government is spending about $800 million, but they're expecting to make about $3 billion by the end of it. Like I said, the hospitality sector alone, $700 million. In fact, it's interesting, the Confederation of Indian Industry, president of the state where the event is being held, said that revenues equivalent to 1 year's worth of business is compressed into 2 months. Now, that's very significant. That's just to give you a sense of how much money is to be made in this. What's also important in an economy like India, where a huge section belongs to the unorganized economic sector, what does this mean? This means a lot of scope and a lot of opportunities for temporary livelihood to the small workers and the small vendors, who will also be gaining a lot from a gathering like this. So you've got the big luxury hotel chains, you've got the big, you've got the small vendors as well.
So everyone is going to benefit, and presumably also the state. That will benefit hugely, won't it?
Absolutely, and that's exactly how it's also been touted. That's why you've got these big industry spokespersons coming out to say that it's going to generate nearly $3 billion for the state government. Uttar Pradesh in central India is the most populous state. It has huge pockets of poverty in many districts of the state. So these kind of economic opportunities are also important, say a lot of analysts as well. And just to go back to, you know, the kind of preparations that are being made for the kind of people they will be hosting, and to give you a sense of the kind of money that is also going to be spent by people, you've got the simple living, which is going to cost anywhere between $50 to $100. You've also got the luxury tents priced between $200 to $250 per night. You've got amenities like private bathrooms, heaters, because it is very cold, you know, especially in the mornings when people are actually going ahead and taking the dip in the water. You've got Wi-Fi facility as well. You've even got premium accommodation that go up to $1,000 per night for guests, offering higher end services. So, you know, and I've been seeing this over the years, and every 12 years when this does happen, you see new additions. It's interesting because it is also an opportunity for the state government to further a little bit of politics as well, to say that, look, we've done this. It's a big event that they showcase in a big way. And as I see over the years, the marketing has also increased in the way in which they actually project this big festival to the outside world as well.
As you say, this event happens every 12 years, but there is a festival calendar, isn't there? And a lot of companies kind of pin their hopes to that festival calendar to boost their sales over the year.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, a lot of consumer goods companies would be hoping for some sort of footfall during this period and expects a little bit of a burst. Because if I could just take a macro vision of everything that's happening in the Indian economy at the moment, the Indian economy on paper is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. But one of the big concerns that is a big pressure point for the Indian economy's growth story is the lack of consumer spending. That's been a huge concern. So a lot of hopes are pinned around periods like Diwali, which you would be aware of, which happens in the month of October and November. Christmas, when you see a big spike in sales, a lot of discounts being offered, a lot of people going ahead and spending as well. This is definitely an opportunity, say a lot of analysts, for businesses to really zero in and focus. That's why you've got a lot of food vendors who've set up stalls, who've set up tents. You've got a lot of hotels setting up their branded tents as well, hoping that this is the time to make a little bit of money. The city of Prayagraj, where this is being held, you see the shops all decked up because they will be seeing a huge number of people coming in and actually going ahead and spending, something that the Indian economy desperately needs.
That was Aruna Day Mukherjee, the BBC's India business correspondent, speaking to me a little earlier on. Well, that's all for today. Thank you very much for listening to the World Business Report. Don't forget, you can always find our podcasts by searching for World Business Report wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And join us again the same time tomorrow.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.